I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9 swingman. He can shoot the three.
Oh, this is so contrived.
I mean, this is America, isn't it?
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the podcast for Tuesday, February 17th, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, a very sick assistant sports editor and softball beat writer. And with me today are...
Christopher Yazbek, women's basketball beat writer.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
Mike McCall, football beat writer and columnist.
Phil Kegler, football beat writer and columnist.
Mike DiFerdinando, basketball beat writer.
All right, we're going to get straight to some breaking news we just saw a little earlier tonight. Phil, tell me about Carl Johnson.
Yeah, offensive lineman Carl Johnson has been arrested today. He's being accused of violating a sexual violence restraining order. Apparently, 1 week ago on Monday, February the 9th, he was served an injunction for protection against sexual violence, according to the police report we have here. And then today, Carl apparently was sitting on an RTS bus with the victim and sat across the aisle from her and then got off the bus at the hub when she did. And apparently this violated the restraining order. He's going to be a redshirt junior come fall. How does this affect the team, Mike?
I think more importantly than anything, this is our first arrest of 2009, so we should all take that in. It's the first of probably a countless number of arrests that we'll experience this year. In terms of the uniqueness of the arrest, I'd give it about a 6. I don't really understand.
It's not as good as the Jimmy Johnson scenario.
That's going to be really hard to top. So the AK-47.
Yeah.
But I don't know how serious this is. It's hard to tell. In the police report, it says that he had several opportunities to get off the bus. I guess he was supposed to know that, you know, he couldn't be that close to her and be on the bus. So I'm not sure how far this is going to go. It's kind of hard to tell. It's kind of weird. So I don't think he's going to get kicked off the team or suspended. I mean, we've certainly seen a lot worse swept under the rug, so there's no reason to think this won't be also. And looking at their offensive line prospects for next year, we were looking over the roster earlier, and it's remarkable how many right guards they have, how many people have played right guard in the past. So it's going to be interesting to see where these guys space out along the line. I mean, Carl Johnson was a pretty big prospect. Took him a little while to develop, but I mean, he's very talented, so he could probably play on a few spots, so they don't need to lose him for any amount of time. But I don't think that they will.
I got two questions for you guys that you probably don't know the answers to. But do we know how he got like the restraining order against him in the first place? And does he have to be like a registered sex offender now? You guys are in law classes. Like, is this an offense that would warrant that?
I do not believe so. I thought sex offender is more for classification against minors.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know how. We just know that he had a restraining order against him for the last week, and now today the police say he violated it, so he's still sitting in jail.
All right, so I guess keep an eye open for more on this story. Obviously, it's just breaking, so we don't know a whole lot yet. So let's move on to some of our other topics for tonight. Let's talk about the men's basketball team. What happened this weekend in Athens, Mike?
Just a catastrophic loss to Georgia is how I would describe it. Georgia was the worst team in the SEC. They hadn't won a game this calendar year, and they couldn't miss against Florida pretty much on Saturday. They shot something ridiculous, like 69% in the first half, 57% overall. Florida loses on the last second play. Irving Walker misses a shot. Can't make an open pass.
Do we think that this is any carryover from the Kentucky loss?
They say no, but I suspect it is to a degree. I think Georgia's a team they definitely overlooked as someone that was an easy win for sure, I think. Kyle?
How do you overlook a team coming off of a loss? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Like, it's cool if, like, your team's rolling and you got a big game coming up next. I don't think Alabama at home is really a big game, but they're circling on the calendar. So to me, after you come off, like, a loss, it's really emotional. You want to bounce back and focus and make sure you get a win. So I don't know that I'd buy the whole they didn't take Georgia seriously argument.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is they only had 5 turnovers. They had 20 assists. They shot okay. They put up, you know, 86 points. It's not like they played terrible. They did what they always do. Like, and they shot pretty well. They didn't turn the ball over. They just didn't play defense. That's what they always do, and this time it bit them. So it was more that Georgia played a good game, I think.
And, yeah, they really wasted a great night offensively. For the first time in, like, it seems like weeks, someone other than Nick Claytis had a big game. Walter Hodge had 22 points. They wasted that. 5 players scored in double figures. So that was really a game they needed to win.
And how bad of a loss is this for the team, man?
It's pretty bad. I mean, they've lost three of the last four now. They're back-to-back losses coming off the Kentucky game and now Georgia. They have a lot of work to do if they want to make the tournament.
Yeah, this loss, like, in just a few hours took them from a team who everyone was fairly sure would make the tournament. I mean, obviously, there were still ways for them not to. But losing this game, I mean, that's easily their worst loss of the season. I mean, Georgia's terrible, so that hurts them bad.
This is a horrible loss because of also the South Carolina road miracle loss that they collapsed. I was saying this after the game. I think you can get away with one catastrophically horrible thing happening to you, but two really puts you in a tough position, especially going, you know, for the rest of the season and the games that they're going to have to win now.
Yeah, and in one game, they went from being on top of the SEC East now in fourth place. So this could have cost them a conference title or at least a shot at one.
All right, so they obviously have a problem with closing out games. And, Kyle, I mean, you wrote a whole thing on the defense being so poor. Can they improve either of those categories?
The defense thing, I think, is more of a game-long problem because, as Billy was quick to point out, they got stops towards the end of the game, although there was one possession. The final shot of the game that Georgia made was Trey Tompkins in the paint. The shot clock was winding down. With about 5 seconds, he hit a jump, like a jump hook type shot in the post that really they needed to stop there. But they played better as both teams seemed to be fatigued and were struggling for points. But consistently throughout the game, they don't close out on shooters. Their guards are so small at playing at the top of the 2-3 that even when they do close out on shooters, it's not that hard for a big guy like Terrence Woodbury to shoot over Walter Hodge or Irvin Walker. And I think that's a real problem they're going to have to address. I don't really know how they fix it. They might need to go to man. And Ray Shipman might need to get more minutes. You might have to trade in some offense that you're getting from Walker or Hodge and put Shipman in there to lock some guys down on defense.
Or maybe it's all Maurice Spate's fault, right, Mike?
Well, yeah, we'll get to Maurice Spate in a minute. But I agree with Kyle. Shipman has to play more if they're going to guard somebody. They've tried to mask their lack of defense with zones and stuff, and it kind of hasn't worked. A lot of times they're just outmatched athletically. I'm not sure what you can really do about that.
All right, so let's talk about the Maurice Spate thing now.
So, Billy Donovan was talking today during his press conference. There was a question asked about UF front court, its lack of size. And Billy seems to think that it's all Maurice Spates' fault, or at least to some degree. Billy said coming into last year, they never expected Spates to leave, so they recruited players accordingly, meaning they got more skilled guys who aren't quite as physical to go alongside Maurice Spates, who they thought would be here. He leaves. Now they're left with guys that were supposed to be kind of complementary players that are now playing a much bigger role, and it's really hurt them.
This is a joke. Like, I was upset to hear Donovan said something like that because I've kind of criticized him the last couple of years for calling out his players publicly and not taking responsibility. And though Maurice Spates isn't a player here anymore, he can't be held responsible for making the best possible decision for himself. Like, Donovan needs to take into account that could happen and have some backup plans. It's really bad for recruiting to be an issue, and then he's saying that we weren't prepared for any kind of situation. I mean, that falls to me on the coaching staff.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that it wasn't very tactful for Donovan to do that, but I can understand his frustration. I mean, if he did build a plan around this guy, I mean, obviously it wasn't smart if there was any possibility Spates was going to jump to the NBA, but I can understand him being very frustrated if he got these guys. He thought, you know, looking down the road, like, okay, we'll have a good team in this year with Spates here and with, you know, highest beside him and, you know, Dan Werner doing whatever he's going to do. I can understand his frustration, but he should have gone about it.
How about manning up, taking some responsibility and saying, hey, I couldn't get Patrick Patterson here. Like, you know, Billy Gillespie, Kentucky beat me out. We didn't get Patrick Patterson. Now we're suffering the effects of missing out on that recruit. I think it's stuff like that that really should be pointed to. And, you know, how college basketball is now, you don't know when guys are going to leave, especially somebody who like Spades, who's a big NBA body with a lot of offensive game. Like, I think it's irresponsible to say that you weren't prepared for something like that.
All right, so how does this affect the team going into the rest of the season? Are they collapsing? Are they done?
I wouldn't say that they're not done. They may or may not be collapsing. It seems there's shades of what happened last year. Around this time last year, they lost to an LSU team who had also fired their coach like Georgia did, and kind of started a downward spiral where they lost 8 of their last 11 games, missed the tournament. They need to start winning. They need to beat Alabama and Vanderbilt this weekend if they want to, you know, get any kind of momentum going forward.
I don't think they're done, and here's why. But I only give them about a 50-50 shot of making the tournament. I think they need 10 wins in conference. I've said that all season. They're at 6 right now. So you got to look at where the 4 are going to come in the last 6 games. They get Alabama and Vanderbilt at home. Both of those are must wins. They have to win those 2 games. They're not great teams, and they're
should wins.
And should wins, correct. So assuming they win those two, they have four games left. They play LSU and Mississippi State on the road. They play Kentucky and Tennessee at home. All four of those are relatively tough games. If they can go 2-2 in those games and split them, which is a realistic goal, that would give them the 10 wins. We assume they don't flame out in the SEC tournament. They win a game or two, and they sneak in as the fifth team in the SEC. I think that scenario is possible.
Do they need to beat Tennessee or Kentucky? Do they need a marquee win, or can they make the tournament without any kind of big win to speak of other than Washington?
I think if they get the four, if they go 4-2 in the final six, they'll make it.
Yeah, I think if they beat LSU and Mississippi State, they lose to Tennessee and Kentucky. I don't think it makes too much of a difference. I don't think Tennessee or Kentucky are such big wins. They're not even in the top 25. LSU on the road is probably a bigger win than either of those two games at this point. So
I would say they have to win at least one game in Tampa, though. I don't think they can lose in the first round.
Yeah, they can't. They can't fall out again. Yeah. Really. The other problem is, like, out of those four teams that you were saying that they need to go 2-2 in, I mean, LSU, Mississippi State, Tennessee, and Kentucky are all trying to make the tournament too. Like, they're going to be going up against teams who need the win just as much as they do, and I don't really like taking them. Situations.
Well, I mean, they're not going to go 4-0, that's for sure. But I think 2-2 is like if you want to be a legitimate team, you should be able to go 2-2 against decent competition. So.
All right. Do we have anything else about the men's basketball team going forward?
I think they will not make the tournament. I'll restate once again.
You don't have to definitively.
I think they still do barely squeak by in the tournament. I think they do split the last four games. I still think they're going to win one of the games at home against Tennessee or Kentucky, and I think they'll win a game or two in the SEC tournament.
I agree with Deeper.
I think they only get 9 wins in the SEC, but they do well in the tournament, and they end up making it.
Sorry I came into this a little late. This is Evan Drexler, sports editor. I don't know if any of you guys saw an email that was sent out today by the UAA. I don't know if you talked about it already. Did you guys talk about this?
No, this is a good point.
Okay, there's an email sent out by the UAA. It was signed from Billy Donovan. I don't know how much input you really had into the email.
Oh, come on, Evan. But, you think he sat down, banged that out, sent it out to the listserv after his press conference?
So Billy Donovan sends out an email today to all the people registered as Rowdy Reptiles with, you know, saying that they're opening up 500 more student section seats for these last couple games. So, I mean, you know, they clearly realize that these games are huge games and they need to win them and they need students there to cheer on.
Was it the last couple games or was it just the Alabama game?
Because I thought it was Alabama, and I'm pretty sure Tennessee was in there too.
Because I thought I saw something like these games aren't on TV, so we're opening this up to you because you
Alabama
can't watch them on TV. So I thought that was what it was.
You know, this is interesting because I heard Jeremy Foley, the athletics director, who coincidentally belongs on the Mount Rushmore of U.S. sports. I heard him on a radio show in Gainesville, and a caller called in and was asking about attendance at basketball games and like what they should do about it. And he said, we should open up more student seats and then that'll fill the arena. And Foley was like, he correctly pointed out, well, no, because the student section isn't always full. So we open up more student seats, we're still going to have empty seats. So I'm wondering what drew them to this conclusion to do this. Maybe it was just that they were pretty sure no one else was going to come besides students. That's the only thing I can think of.
We've been through the whole like lack of fanship before, lack of people in the seats, but I mean, you got to do what you got to do to get people there, right?
Yeah, two things on that. I think they're just trying – those seats are going to go unused, they suspect, so they're just trying to get anybody in there because they want some kind of an advantage down the stretch here. And what was interesting to me, too, is at the Georgia game, there was a decent UF representation there. Like, they started chants, actually, in the Georgia Dome – or in the Georgia Dome. in Stegman, and it was really interesting. I thought they actually had a really good showing there, which I can't possibly explain how that happens, but they can't show up at home games.
Well, Atlanta has one of the Gator Booster Club in Atlanta is huge. You can even get like a Florida Gators license plate now in Georgia because of that group lobbying the government. So they always have good support up there.
Yeah, I was at that game too, and I was also really impressed by the orange and blue going out and cheering for the Gators in Athens.
All right, now is that it for basketball? We've been through this before, but are we good?
Sorry to bring up an extra point. Sorry to bust in on you guys.
It's all right.
But we got more basketball.
We do.
Variety.
Sort of.
Oh, no. Coming up a little later, but I believe we have some more Carl Johnson news from Evan, who entered late.
Yeah, the reason I entered late is I was trying to get some more information about the Carl Johnson arrest. I was getting police reports, and I got a text message from UF media relations guy Steve McClain, and his message says, and I quote, "We are aware of the report and we are in the process of gathering all of the details." So that's what McClain had to say about the Carl Johnson thing, which I don't know what you guys think about that kind of statement, but and also at the end of it was Coach Meyer is out of the country, so Urban Meyer is not in the country right now. I don't know how much he knows about this arrest at all.
Who cares?
I'm going to say that I could have written that statement from Steve McClain, you know, yesterday.
Yeah, that's
that,
what
that's
I would expect.
Cool.
I mean, it is kind of weird reading the report. You don't know what's going on, so they need to make sure they get all the facts together.
I might joke about this before, about being the first arrest of the year, but like, seriously, what do we think for over-under on arrest this season, maybe?
Are we talking your football team or overall athletic?
Football team.
We got to get just football.
Over-under five?
I'd said five. That's perfect. That's exactly what I was
That's
saying.
A ludicrous thing to even talk about, like an over-under for arrest.
But you laugh about it, but how many arrests have there been in the last year? I mean.
Well, there were two in November, right? It was Rickerson.
There's Cam Newton.
And Cam Newton.
Like back-to-back home runs.
Yeah,
those two.
As long as Tim Tebow's not getting arrested, I think they're all right, though.
All right, so let's move on from that and talk about women's basketball, which Yazbek is pumping his fist for. Chris, let's talk about what happened
to
the women's team.
So basically, the women's team beats Tennessee last Sunday and comes back with two big-time road losses at Vanderbilt and LSU, two top six teams in the conference. But really, they were never in it from the start in either of those games. Vanderbilt game, they couldn't play any defense, and LSU just shut them down, and they couldn't score at all. So, I mean, LSU, they had 2 points with, like, 9 minutes and 20 seconds left in the first half. So, basically, this women's team has to rebound, and they're playing two home games this week against South Carolina and Arkansas. Should win them both, and they're still playing for a bye in the first round of the SEC tournament. They're probably not going to win the regular season title now. So, they have a lot to play for still, and just a tough week.
All right, well, let's go back and talk about those losses a little bit. I mean, were these bad, unexpected, just terrible losses? I mean, what went wrong with them?
It really wasn't unexpected completely. I mean, Vanderbilt was the preseason pick to win the SEC, so that one wasn't unexpected at all. And then LSU, you know, they've been to five straight Final Fours, and they're top defensive team in the conference. And so really it was unexpected the way the Gators started both of those games, because the emphasis from Amanda Butler has been the first 4 minutes, and they didn't come out with any energy in either of those games. So that was the, you know, the most shocking part from watching that.
Do you think that they were a little bit overrated, slipping into the top 10 in the polls, getting to 9? I mean, I think the Tennessee win was like this big. It was like it was blown up to be this huge thing, even though Tennessee was really down this season. So do you think that they shouldn't have? They're really not the number 9 team in the nation.
Yeah, I think they were a little overhyped. And the thing is, they haven't won a major road game this season. They've beaten Florida State. That was earlier in the season on the road. But really, in conference play, they've lost at Auburn by 16, at Vanderbilt by 16, and now at LSU by 19. And so really blown out in all three of those games. And they've yet to prove themselves in a major road game. So.
Much like the men's team.
Well, Florida State's ranked now, right? Isn't Florida State in top?
Florida State's actually ranked ahead of them now.
Yeah, so
number 14.
So I mean, that in retrospect, that's a big road win.
Right, right. But as far as conference play, they haven't done anything respectful against a big team.
All right. So do we still think this team is as good as we said they were earlier? I mean, tournament. How far into the tournament are they going here?
I mean, I still think it's very likely that they'll make the Sweet 16. I still think because they have a very good shot that they're going to win their last three games. They got the two at home, and then they got to go to Georgia. I might be a good chance to get a little bit of confidence away from Gainesville. You know, and I think it's going to be crucial for them to get that bye in the SEC tournament. I think they'll win a couple games there, maybe make it to the semifinals, be like a 4 or 5 seed, and make it Sweet 16.
You don't think this exposes them at all? They got blown out, two straight games.
I mean, I think it exposes them, but I think, you know, maybe it's something that they'll learn from, a learning experience. They're re-realizing that they're not as good as they think they are.
Well, I mean, Chris, like you said, they started so poorly in both those games, and I think you said 2 points, like 11 minutes in the game. That's incredible. But what goes into that? You said they didn't come out with energy, but is it just that – I mean, is it heavily dependent on how they shoot on a given night?
You know, I mean, Amanda Butler said, you know, she doesn't expect to shoot well from three every single night, and they rely a lot on three-pointers. But, you know what I mean, when you're missing free throws, they were like 12 of 22 from free throws the other night against LSU. When you're not scoring where you should be scoring, and – you know, they've gotten foul trouble against Vanderbilt. Like, Marshae Dotson picked up two fouls right off the bat. And so that had a major effect on really the way they've started games. So, and it's just been too much to recover from that, from an early deficit. So,
getting back to the, does this expose them? I think it definitely does. I mean, they were riding such a high, and they were, like, potentially going to make, you know, run at a 2 seed. I remember Chris was talking about before, which I think was definitely legitimate to say after the Tennessee win. And now they lose, you know, they lose by, like, blowouts, you know, on the road, two straight games. So I think you definitely have to go back and look and say, you know, this team's probably, you know, they're a solid team, they're a good team, they're going to be in the top 25 all year, they're going to make the tournament, but let's not put them in the Elite Eight or Final Four just yet. So.
All right, do we got anything else about the women's basketball team before we move on to our next topic here?
How was Shea Brooks in those two games?
Shea Brooks was not that great at all. Actually, she didn't have any great scoring nights or anything. So
you want to uncarve her face from the Mount Rushmore, Phil?
I mean, as long as we're putting in Jeremy Foley, who deserves to be there.
Yeah, you got some help with you now. So. I just think it's incredible how bad this week was for Florida basketball in general.
Yeah.
I mean, you had the women's team who you were saying potential 2-seed in the tournament, and the men's team who, I don't know, maybe could have won the SEC.
I don't mean to get ridiculous, but yes, Phil was showing me or telling me last night, and it's actually true. ESPN was somebody, I forget who it was, it wasn't Lenardi, but somebody else was saying, if Florida had won the SEC and finished in impressive fashion before this week, they could have also had a 2-seed, the men's team.
There's no way.
You know, if they did that, I mean, they'd have a decent chance to make a run because they'd be playing, you know, chumps in the tournament. Not chumps, but a lot easier than what they're going to have to do is like a 10-seed or an 11-seed.
Just hope they don't get BCU. So Anthony Grant's going to show up his boy, Billy Donovan. So.
All right, well, with that, the terrible week in Florida basketball in general behind us, let's move on to softball. They played, the softball team played 5 games this weekend, 5 games in 3 days. They won all of them, absolutely dominated, put 56 runs on the board, only allowed one. Stephanie Brombacher threw a 5-inning no-hitter Saturday. Francesca Nea alone had 2 grand slams Saturday. It's an unbelievable weekend for the softball team. But interestingly enough, they made a couple of changes, which was unexpected from Coach Tim Walton coming into the weekend. He switched up Asia Pakuba, made her the leadoff hitter, and put Kim Wallazzoni at second. And Kyle, Wallazzoni has batted leadoff her entire career here, right?
Yeah, she's hit leadoff. Her freshman year, there was a small period of time where she didn't hit leadoff. She hit, like, maybe down the order 5th or 6th or something like that. But she's hit leadoff for 2 years here. She's been great at it. She's a great bunter for base hits. And I didn't really understand the move at first, because Pakulba has a lot of power. What does she have, 4 home runs already on the season?
Yeah, she's tied for the team lead.
Yeah, so she's got a lot of power, so it doesn't really make sense to have her leading off. But she is extremely fast, and she gets on base a lot. The only thing I can think of is Wallazzoni is such a good bunter, and if Asia's going to get on base in front of her anyway, if she doesn't bunt for a hit, then she's moving over a runner anyway. So I don't know. That's the logic I see in it. But other than that, I don't really quite get it.
Well, I mean, it worked for them, absolutely. They weren't playing great competition, obviously. But, you know, considering the offensive struggles they had against Baylor that first weekend, and then they just tore it up this weekend. So, I mean, it's absolutely working for them, right?
Well, I don't think that's the move that turned it around. I think they were going to do this regardless of where those two hit against this level of competition. They did it all last year in the same way. So, I mean, it obviously wasn't a hindrance. It didn't throw things off. Nobody was affected mentally or whatever, but I don't think this, like, turned around the offense. They were just facing a great pitcher in Canyon, you know? I mean, they scored 8 runs on Baylor when she didn't pitch, so I think it really just comes back to how good she was.
True. Walton absolutely loved the move, though. Like, he literally said he loved it 3 times in a row. So
he patted himself on the back, probably.
Yeah, he was very happy with himself.
Yeah.
The other thing worth noting from this weekend, Brombacher with a no-hitter, which Stacey Nelson has never had on her career, correct?
Yes, she's never thrown a no-hitter in her career. Stacey has not.
All right, and as a result, Brombacher was named SEC Pitcher of the Year, and Anaya,
Pitcher of the Week.
Pitcher of the Week. Sorry. Not to be giving titles out prematurely.
Crowner.
But Anaya was also given SEC Player of the Week, not year, week, for hitting 2 grand slams, matching her career total, actually, in one day, which was quite impressive. Did you get to see any of the games this weekend? Did you get to see?
I didn't get to see any of the games, but I kept up with them best I could via your blog and text messages and Gamecast, stuff like that. And 2 things on that is that Anaya's been amazing so far. Looks better than last year, which you got to feel great about if you're part of that team or you're a fan of the team, because her knee was in question coming into the season. And Brombacher throwing the no-hitter, like, I really don't want to go here, but you didn't watch the team all last year. Watching them pretty much for the first time this season. You know what you've heard coming in. Has Brombacher looked better or as good as Nelson to you? Because it's hard for me to make that jump because I watched them all of last season. But we might have to start talking about that, as crazy as it is.
I think so, honestly. I mean, it's like you said before, she is facing second-tier pitching for the most part, so she's getting run support, you know, from her side. But yeah, just in the circle, she's looked just as solid as Nelson.
She's not even giving up any hits right now. It's disgusting. Like, I mean, she had the no-hitter, but then she's thrown, what, a couple one-hitters and two-hitters, mm-hmm. and she's looked pretty much untouchable to start the season. She's been great, and I laughed at Walton for the whole, like, we have two number ones, she's just as good, she's pushing Stacy comments at the beginning of the year, but it really looks like it's come true at this point.
He even said she had a better fall, better, you know, spring practice than Stacy did. It's not like Stacy's had a bad year. I mean, she's absolutely given up one earned run this whole time. So.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's really splitting hairs when you get down to the two of them. They've both been so good. But I think Brombacher's proven a lot, and she's done really well. And, you know, when she starts to face better hitting, then we'll be able to reevaluate at that point as well.
And we should be seeing that starting Thursday because they're going into a tournament where they're playing 5 games, I believe, 4 against a ranked team. So they will start to face some decent competition here.
Yeah, the California trip's always big. It's, you know, you're out of your environment a little bit, and they're playing some really quality competition out there. So the results they bring home this weekend will be a good indicator of where they're at this point in time.
All right, anything else about softball from the 4 people who've remained quiet throughout this segment?
They are playing Arizona State. They're number 3.
Yep, so they are.
2-3.
Yep.
All right. Champs Arizona State.
What was that?
Defending champion, Arizona State.
All right. Well, then let's, I guess we're going to wrap this up then. Go ahead and send any feedback you have to sports@alligator.org or leave any comments on our blog. We should be back with a podcast this Friday, and keep an eye on the Alligator for more coverage of all these sports as they play their midweek games. So thanks for listening, and we're out.